First, we want to look at the Republicans, the US Republicans, and environmental matters. For the past 30 or 40 years, there's been a fairly clear distinction between the two major parties in the US, as in Australia. The Conservatives, the Republicans, are the party of business over the environment, whereas the Progressives, the Democrats, are constantly trying to walk that delicate line between environmental protection and the jobs of their, well, their traditional working class base. But it was not always thus. My next two guests have written a fascinating history of the Republican Party's changing relationship with the environment. But not to worry, I promise you it isn't a dry enumeration of policy positions. It really gets deeply into a fundamental philosophical shift that has occurred in the conservative movement in the US and which, of course, has greatly influenced Australia. The book is called The Republican Reversal, Conservatives and the Environment from Nixon to Trump. Isn't it great? We start off quoting my two favourite US presidents. Your authors are Andrew Eisenberg, Professor of American History at the University of Kansas, and James Morton Turner, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at Wellesley College. Jay and Drew, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Drew, before we get to the historical approach of the Republicans, can you just talk us through some of Trump's environmental rollbacks? Remind us just how bad he has been.
Sure. Let me try and see what I can do. I think one of the most notable things that he's rolled back has been his announcement that he wants to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, the Paris Climate Agreement. That was something he was very clear he wanted to do on the campaign trail, and it was one of the first things he announced when he took office. I think a lot of the things he's done, though, have been quieter. That's one of the sort of big splashy things that he did. For the most part, what he has done is to appoint people to run the Environmental Protection Agency and the Interior Department who have quietly, behind the scenes, changed a lot of the rulemaking procedures and made a lot of changes to the way certain kinds of environmental protections will be calculated. And these are changes that they're allowed to do because this is part of the executive branch. They're administrative changes that these branches are allowed to make. And so it's doing an end run around the legislative branch in the United States. And there's a public comment period, but for the most part, these are changes that the Trump administration can push through. And they have to do with the ability to mine on public lands, logging, drilling, seeking coal on public lands, protections in terms of what will count as waters that need to be protected waters within the United States. It's something called the Waters of the United States Rule. So in a number of ways, the Trump administration has quietly rolled back a lot of very complicated protections that I think a lot of Americans don't know about, but they count on.
Jay, when everyone was on holes between Christmas and the New Year, the Donald announced some pretty radical changes to emissions standards. What's he proposing?
You're right. So one of the cornerstone environmental laws in the United States is the Clean Air Act. And since 1970, it's really been the backstop for ensuring that Americans have clean, healthy air that they can breathe. And there are a number of different provisions of the Clean Air Act, but one of the important ones regulates hazardous emissions, including mercury, which is a neurotoxin and one that affects children, pregnant women, other vulnerable populations more so than others. And the change they made was to change how they assessed the value of curbing mercury emissions. And as Drew was referring to, this is kind of some of the nitty-gritty of how rules are made, but it's a question of whether you get to factor in some of the co-benefits, some of the extra things that come when you clean up a power plant to keep the mercury out. What are the other things you keep out of the air at the same time? The Obama administration counted the extra things, which really highlighted how positive for public health this rule was. The Trump administration wants to say, nope, you can only carry count a very narrow set of things. And when you do that, the value of this rule protecting public health from mercury emissions looks much, much smaller than it actually is. So that's kind of the, you know, the tricky kind of rulemaking that they're engaging in.
Jay, will his impact be reversible? Let's fantasize that someone like Elizabeth Warren is elected president in 2020. How long, for example, would it take for an organization like the EPA to recover?
You know, that's clearly a very important question and one that a lot of us are already starting to think about as we look forward. But I think even more urgent than is it, you know, reversible, how long will it take? I think the bigger question is how many of these rules and changes that they're putting into place will actually stick? And when I say stick, I mean, you know, are they going to be determined to be legal? So even though the Trump administration can make lots of changes through the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of the Interior, as Drew was saying, they have to make changes that are defensible in the U.S. federal courts. They have to abide by the existing legislation. And many of the changes that they're pushing are, you know, really pushing the envelope of what the laws were intended to do, what they allow. And you can be sure that every environmental organization's burning the midnight oil in the U.S., challenging these laws in court. And so I think we're at a moment where right now, all we're hearing about are the rollbacks, but we haven't heard about how they're going to be contested and overturned in court. So I think, you know, are they going to be reversible in time? Yes, but probably even sooner. The question is just how many actually stay in place.
In some ways, of course, Trump's manias have been useful to progressives in that there's been such a blowback. We'll take the Paris Accord that you were discussing. It has tended to produce some pretty energetic responses at state level, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think the state where you can see most of this happening is the state of California, which has long had air quality standards that are higher than federal standards. And they've pushed forward to try to put in place, at least a state level, the kind of economic changes and economic regulations that would get them closer to being carbon neutral, much more so than federal standards would have.
I'm old enough to remember the wallop of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Carson, rather, you were an inaugural fellow, Drew, at the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society in Munich. So you're well placed to tell us about the book. What was its impact?
The impact of Rachel Carson, I think, was extraordinary. It was the right book at the right time in terms of her ability to take a very complicated scientific nomenclature. You know, it was a complicated procedure and complicated things that she was talking about. She had the ability to write in a way that made this understandable and persuasive to a reading public. She'd already established herself as a nature writer, and yet she could understand the chemistry and the biology as well. And so it came at just the right moment when you had a number of Americans who had started to become concerned about a number of chemical products that had entered the American marketplace in the 1950s and the early 1960s. And also, I have to say, a number of Americans who had moved into suburbs and they'd moved to those places to try to have some greenery in their lives as part of the enormous suburbanization in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. And instead, they found they were stuck in traffic jams. The green spaces that they thought were there were starting to disappear. There was pollution they were contending with. And this is one of the things we tried to get at in the opening chapters of the book, which is that those suburbs were bastions of the Republican Party in the 1950s and 1960s. And they were also places where support for environmentalism, the kind of environmentalism that Rachel Carson started, was extraordinarily strong. So at least in the early 1960s, and actually continuing for much of the 1960s, there were many ordinary Republican voters who were actually quite in support of these kinds of environmental protections.
Jay, it would surprise many Australian listeners, not this ancient presenter, that we can trace the Republican Party's support for the environment back to Theodore Roosevelt and the dawn of the 20th century. As I recall, he was the president that declared Yosemite the first national park.
Roosevelt declared many federal lands to be national forests, to be national parks. He created the first national monuments. So, you know, all of this was part of the very early history of the Republican Party's commitment to kind of the United States nationalism, protecting, you know, these scenic areas for the people was, you know, one key part of the Republican Party's early environmental agenda. And part of it was, you know, protecting parks for people to go and visit and to protect the wildlife there. But part of it was also stewarding the resources, the forests, the rivers, and managing them in efficient and economically productive ways. So, you know, the Republican Party, right from the start of the 20th century, following Theodore Roosevelt's lead, saw, you know, a central role for the federal government in protecting the public interest in the environment.
Ah, Theodore, where are you now that we need you? This is LNL on RN. You can hear the program on the ABC Listen app, online or even on an old-fashioned wireless. My guests, James Morton and Andrew Eisenberg, authors of The Republican Reversal, Conservatives and the Environment from Nixon to Trump. Once again, I'm old enough to remember Barry Goldwater of loving memory. In 1964, the Republican candidate for president, he'd lose in a landslide to Johnson, who was the incumbent. But this was a momentous shift for the soul of the party, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And really, if there's one of the things that emerges strongly from the book is a sense that a Republican Party that was moderate or had many moderates within it, and because of that was more than willing to support environmental protections, that as that party was gradually taken over by conservatism, you saw a real decline in Republicans' willingness to support environmental protections. But interestingly, that did not apply to Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater was one of the co-sponsors of the Clean Air Act of 1970. And he was someone who was dead set against federal government regulation in the economy. He wanted to roll back federal control of public lands in Arizona, which was his home state, because the federal government controlled much of the land in Arizona. And yet, at the same time, he was able to express a lot of support for certain things, such as the Clean Air Act. So even conservatism in the 1960s was not as opposed to environmental protection as it has become now.
It's interesting, that paradox of Goldwater, a vocal opponent of civil rights and an advocate for clean air. Drew, one of the big surprises, and the book is full of them, is seeing Richard Nixon, who used to be the most hated American president, emerge as an unlikely hero of the environment. And I understand it all started with an oil spill in California in 1969.
Yes, in fact, we just passed the anniversary of that oil spill a couple of days ago. That oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara happened within a couple of weeks of Nixon's inauguration, and it dominated the news in the early days of his administration. And I don't think he came into office thinking that he wanted to be an environmentalist. But at the same time, I think he was a savvy politician, and he sensed that the environment was, at a time when the United States is at war, when civil rights is a really divisive issue for Americans at the time, he saw environmentalism as a kind of uniting issue where he could get on the right side of this and try to build some political support for himself. And in some ways, he's not terribly different from Goldwater in this respect. A lot of what Richard Nixon tried to do in a very savvy way was to peel away constituencies from the Democratic Party. And that meant, on the one hand, trying to win over environmentalists. And it also meant, because the Democratic Party had a lot of Southern segregationists still in it in the 1960s, appealing to Southern whites as well. And that's not a strategy that necessarily makes sense in terms of any kind of ideological consistency, but as a short-term tactical thing, I think that's what Richard Nixon was trying to accomplish.
In 1970, he launches the environmental decade. Let's just remind ourselves, the Clean Air Act, 1970, the creation of the Environment Protection Agency. In 1970, 20 million Americans took part in the first Earth Day, and that was supported by both sides of politics, Drew.
Yes, absolutely. There's the Clean Water Act in 1972, there's the Endangered Species Act in 1973, and you mentioned the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Richard Nixon created that by executive order. So, and when he went to be renominated for the presidency in 1972, the Republican platform had talked extensively about the environment and the extent to which the Republicans had supported this. And that changed by the end of the 1970s. Republicans had started to run away from this, and actually we're talking about rolling back these protections.
Jay, let's jump to 1980 and a very important Supreme Court decision, Tennessee Valley Authority versus Hill. Tell us about that.
That decision was an important turning point because it was about one of these laws that had been put into place in 1973, the Endangered Species Act, that I guess was kind of notable for two things. One was that everybody supported the Endangered Species Act. Everybody wanted to protect brown pelicans and bald eagles and gray wolves and all of these species that were endangered, and nobody had any real sense for what it was going to take to accomplish that goal. And the way this law was written is that it had, you know, great implications for development projects and management of public lands and other lands in the United States. And that lawsuit becomes so important because that is when kind of those who were interested in developing, in this case a river, realized just how that they were not going to be able to build the dam that they wanted to build. And this was another part of the federal government. Because of the Endangered Species Act, you know, that's what led to this court, this legal suit.
And it involved a very small fish, a snail darter.
That's right. It did involve the snail darter, which was not a gray wolf, and it was not a bald eagle. And I think for conservatives, right, I mean, what this lawsuit was really about is it just signaled that these environmental laws had gotten out of control. What they had supported, what they had helped put into place in the 1960s and the early 1970s, they had created a set of policies that they could not fully control. And now they were facing the consequences of that, not just with the Endangered Species Act, but regulations on business and other activities with the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And all of that is part of what leads to the backlash that we see going into the 1980s and then continuing on to present.
Well, as the book points out, this is the time when the soul of the Republican Party is shifting. We see business groups energized, the emergence, of course, of think tanks.
This is something that Republicans were pushing for in the 1970s. They saw the extent to which left-leaning academics had seized a lot of the momentum in public discourse in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And a number of conservatives were ruing that they were constantly backpedaling and they were not able to dominate the discourse in the way that they wanted. And so they set about in the 1970s to create think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute. These were all founded by very wealthy industrialists who had had a long-standing opposition to federal regulation of the economy. And one of the other things they did was they pushed for the creation, not just of think tanks, but of public interest law firms that would sue the government over kind of test cases where they thought there was a weak link in the government regulatory armor. And so they tried to push for ways to pull apart the kind of legal apparatus that was behind the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And one of the people who was at the head of one of these legal foundations, the Mountain States Legal Foundation, was James Watt, who became Reagan's first Secretary of the Interior.
I'm glad you've mentioned Watts because I remember him with terrible clarity. We currently have a Prime Minister who was a Pentecostalist, a happy clapper, and that was what Watts was about. I seem to recall that he regarded the end times as rapidly approaching, and so the earth didn't need to be looked after.
Well, I have to say, I have actually heard people say just that thing. Not say that Watt believed those things, but I have heard people express that point of view, that there's no need to worry about husbanding resources because we don't need to worry about that. It's in God's hands. What I do want to say, though, is that it's a complicated relationship between Christian fundamentalists and this anti-environmental regulatory movement. They're both part of the conservative movement in the 1970s and well into the 1980s. But in that period, the Christian fundamentalists have a different agenda. They're not concerned about the environment. They're interested in prayer in school and a host of other social and cultural issues. And James Watt certainly had those religious beliefs. Whether or not that was fully informing what he was doing, that's a harder thing to say. I would say that anyone who Ronald Reagan appointed to be his Secretary of Interior after he took office in 1981 would have done many of the same things that James Watt did, with or without those various religious beliefs. Anyone who came in as Secretary of the Interior with Reagan's agenda would have done what James Watt did, which was to open up public lands to oil, gas, coal exploration, and open up offshore waters to oil drilling.
So back to you, Jay. What we witness during the Reagan era is a sort of a pre-echo of Trump. There's a rollback on environmental legislation. There's a weakening of the EPA. There's an encouragement to do naughty things in federal lands and parks.
I think in many ways you're right. I mean, we're seeing kind of the culmination of things that, policies and strategies that Reagan helped set in motion in the 1980s. And, you know, kind of the list that you just give is a kind of a good short list of, you know, kind of the broad attack that the Reagan administration posed for environmental protections. I think, you know, one thing that's interesting to note, though, is Reagan was a two-term president. And by the time Reagan got to his second term, you know, it had become very clear that the anti-environmental cards that he had been playing when he came into office, appointing people like Watt, his EPA administrator was Ann Gorsuch, who was viewed as one of the least successful administrators of the Environmental Protection Agency, second only to our current administrator. And, you know, so he appointed these people, and the public opinion, the pushback he got from not just Democrats, but moderate Republicans was significant in the 1980s. And so by the time you get into Reagan's second term, he's actually appointed some people who have been environmental leaders, like William Ruckelshaus comes in as the EPA administrator. And it was actually Reagan who, in his administration, that led the U.S. in the negotiations that led to the Montreal Protocol, right, which is the international policy to reduce chlorofluorocarbons that go up to the stratosphere and degrade the ozone layer. So one of the signal international environmental policy achievements was one that the Reagan administration played an important part in its second term.
At a time when George H.W. Bush is being beatified, it's important to know that it was he who expanded coal mining in federal lands. In fact, George W. was a comparative lefty on these sort of issues, wasn't he?
George W. Bush?
I'm not sure I would go so far as to say that George W. Bush was a lefty on these kinds of environmental issues. One of the first things that his administration did, and this was before 9/11, so it before that issue came to dominate almost the entire rest of his presidency, was to issue a statement on energy and opening up energy policy and opening up lands in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. And this was a task force that he put together, and it was run by his vice president, Dick Cheney. And it was, I'm not sure that lefty would quite qualify in terms of character.
It was being ironic, but
yes. No, I mean, the point that I would like to suggest here, and this is both to pick up on my last answer and picking up on what Jay just said, which is that it's not as if Ronald Reagan came in and appointed James Watt and we've had an unimpeded history since then of conservatives who knew exactly what they wanted to do at that point, and it's been, you know, it's been not very different from what we have now with Trump since that moment. As Jay was pointing out, with Ronald Reagan taking the lead in pushing for the Montreal Protocols, and in his second term backing off from some of those earlier things that he did, it's much the same as the earlier question that you asked about the sort of religious influence on some of these Republican policies now. Well, nowadays, there is on the evangelical right an idea called dominion theology, where they really believe that it's the purpose of human beings to just exploit as many resources as they can. But that's not what they were thinking when Ronald Reagan took office in 1980. So in much the same way that the Republican Party evolved from the 1960s and 1970s from its support for environmental regulation, they've even evolved since the rise of conservatism and Ronald Reagan to become much more hardcore than they were then.
Tell me, Jay, about the impact of the Tea Party.
The Tea Party was important. The Tea Party was very much focused on a response to the Obama administration during his first 2 years in office. And in part, it was something that, you know, conservative think tanks had helped lay the groundwork for. It certainly had ties to evangelical Christians. And often when people think of the Tea Party, you know, what they focus on is opposition to healthcare reform, which was, you know, a central issue during Obama's first term. But also during Obama's first term, you know, Obama was and his administration were making real efforts working with Democrats who were controlling Congress, at least for the first 2 years of his administration, to move far-reaching legislation to address climate change. And the Tea Party played a really important role in rallying conservatives and, you know, not just conservative, you know, businessmen or conservative politicians, but grassroots, rank-and-file conservatives, folks who were farmers and working in blue-collar jobs, working in manufacturing jobs, rallying a lot of broad opposition to legislation that would move the United States towards a clean energy economy. And there was a moment there in 2009, 2010, where it seemed like the U.S. might pass some far-reaching legislation, and the Tea Party and that mobilization really undid any possibility. There were other factors at work too, but the Tea Party was important.
Tell me about the Koch brothers in this context. Did they write out some large checks, Jay?
It's always a little bit hard to follow the money, but there's no question that the Koch brothers supported Americans for Prosperity. Americans for Prosperity was a Washington, D.C.-based lobby that also did a lot of grassroots outreach. And, you know, one of the campaigns they ran during those years was kind of a hot air balloon campaign, where they had a hot air balloon that went around kind of rural parts of the United States, and they would float it up over farm fields. And essentially emblazoned on this hot air balloon was basically kind of paraphrasing here, but it said, you know, climate change policy is going to cost you your job. And, you know, they would go around and spread this message, and that, you know, helped affect the politics a great deal.
We're out of time, but I want to ask a final question. I mentioned earlier the wild hypothesis of an Elizabeth Warren presidency. She supports the Green New Deal. Would you tell us what that is? Thanks, Drew.
Well, the idea of a Green New Deal has been around for a long time. In fact, that very term showed up in Barack Obama's 2008 platform. So it's been something that people in the Democratic Party and on the left generally in the United States have been advocating for some time. Exactly what it means has not yet been fully defined. It's not like the real New Deal, and we can talk about, you know, the Agricultural Adjustment Agency and the different kinds of programs that they put in. The Green New Deal is more of an aspiration than it is an actual set of policy proposals at this point. My sense is, unfortunately, that although Democrats retook the House of Representatives in the most recent midterm elections that we had, that the relatively moderate Democrats who are running the House of Representatives now do not think that environmental issues generally, and the Green New Deal in particular, is an issue that has legs for them politically. It's not going to win them a lot of votes. It's not going to expand their constituency. And it strikes me that they are thinking in a much more tactical way about trying to win the 24-hour news cycle and the weekly news cycle. And though there are some advocates for the Green New Deal, particularly Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is a very dynamic and charismatic newly elected congressional representative, I don't think yet that there's a groundswell for it.
Gentlemen, I thank you both very much for your time. Jay and Drew, you can read much more in their book. It's called The Republican Reversal, Conservatives and the Environment from Nixon to Trump by James Morton and Andrew Eisenberg. Oh, it's published by Harvard University Press.